is going to be Jonathan Harlow.
Now, my talk will be in two parts. Causation and explanation, and spoiler coming up, I'm against causation and for explanation. So, causation. What's that word? Who made that word up? What's it for? Inform, it's just one of those bogus Latin words that means causing, but with a gown and mortarboard on. A bit like respiration for breathing, or conjugation for... you get my point. Right. But under this cap and gown of respectability, some rather bogus ideas are often being smuggled in. First up is the notion that there's some sort of common process underlying different sorts of causation or causings. Water causes iron to rust, or iron oxide tends to form on an iron surface in the wet. Okay. Gravity causes bodies to fall from the sky, i.e. the attraction of the Earth to a cricket ball is greater than that of the cricket ball to the Earth in proportion to their respective masses. A prism causes a spectrum to appear. Light travelling through a prism becomes ordered by frequency. Now, I challenge anyone to show that these processes are physically alike in any way. We can look at each one, see it happening, and what happens in any one case is quite different from any other. Indeed, as Hume famously pointed out, we are never sensible of any connection between causes and effects. That is, we never observe such a connection. We never perceive causation at work. But one way they can be found alike is through a rather misleading metaphor, a metaphor of force. A making B happen. And indeed, often a sort of metaphor of agency. But anyhow, setting the gods apart, where is the force involved in rusting? Where's the force involved in refraction? This model of causation also seems to operate by separating two objects or events, one as cause, the other as event or effect. Sorry, one's effect. But this is a rather arbitrary construct imposed on what might just as well be thought of as a continuous process. The balls hitting the window caused it to break. Is there really a useful sense in which the hitting of the window and the breaking of the glass were two separate events? Okay. We can restore the respectability of the metaphor by appeal to the laws of nature. Surely laws make things happen in a regular and consistent fashion. And the concept of causation is, as some kind of process is, typically applied to those events which seem to happen regularly and consistently. Iron always rusts in certain situations. Smaller bodies always fall down to earth. Spectrums always appear in the right circumstances. But that law is, as it happens, a very good metaphor for natural regularity. In the political domain, where the metaphor starts, law describes what ought to happen, but often doesn't. Even God's laws are broken. His laws, like ours, are enforced by way of punishment on the many, many occasions when people don't do what the law says they should. But nature doesn't go around punishing naughty, naughty iron that resists rusting or deviant balls that stay up in the air. So the idea of a natural law is rather different from a human law. It's supposed to be what always happens. But we mustn't be circular. We infer a law when we find a regularity. We can't then invoke the law to explain the regularity. And in fact, all we mean by a law is a perceived regularity. And when we find an exception to what we thought the law was, we don't say the law was broken. We rewrite the law. Well, this concept of causation as some kind of active process making things happen leads to one or two well-known problems. For example, sequence. The metaphor calls for cause to precede event, or outcome, or effect. Does the refraction of light precede the spectrum? Does it matter that gravity was operating before Alice let the ball go? And, to take up a frequently discussed issue, can there be negative causation? Not watering it caused the Aspidistra to die. We see here an absent cause. Comes worse, it comes in the form of my not watering it caused the Aspidistra to die. But what if someone else had watered it? So we better run through about 7 billion people whose negligence, i.e. not doing something, killed the Aspidistra. Yeah, you lot included. Well, maybe you don't. But hold on. What about all those years and years when none of you watered my Aspidistra and it didn't die? I think that lets you out. But of course, we can reframe the point. My Aspidistra died because nobody watered it. So now we have a culprit or a cause. It was Mr. Nobody. I.e. back to the absent agent. But the diversion is worthwhile. Because what we've done is to expose the notion of the single cause of this or that. The cause of the Aspidistra's death was lack of water, but the cause of the lack of water was that I did not water it and nobody else did, and there was no other source of water. Lots of absent causes here. Or to put it another way, we have to forget about X as the cause of Y and say that X is a cause of Y. And that point might become even stronger when we look at the causation of a non-effect. Just what was the cause that made my house not fall down yesterday? Made it not fall down, mark you. Well, a bit like this, perhaps. Only complicated. And really large. Pan out to include the nature of this. Plants in general, the ecology of our planet, cosmos, etc. The cause of everything is everything. Indeed, as Anne put it, our universe is a singularity, so any regularities we want to find are going to be found in parallel universes. Anyhow, we're certainly bursting out of the metaphor of causation as something that makes something else happen into the rather milder tones of X making something more likely. Probabilities do indeed seem to bust the link with laws of nature. Instead of saying whenever X, always Y, we have whenever X, often Y. not much chain of causation here. Now, at this point, I expect an interruption from a gang of those philosophers who still want to reduce the events of the real world to logical propositions. So, we can gain by renaming causes and conditions, then separating the necessary from sufficient conditions. So throwing a die at all is a necessary condition of throwing a six. Boy, that clarifies things a lot. And what is a sufficient condition of throwing a six? Throwing the die often enough? Like, just how often must that be, please? I suppose having a die with a six on every face would be a sufficient condition for throwing a six. Certainly there's sufficient condition for getting thrown off the craps table with extreme prejudice. Now, we've already had this one from Bob's question, but I'm going to take it up briefly again, just to be a tad more specific with it. Let's take the road accident. As far as we can gather, this lorry got into the accident by failing to stop. And it didn't stop because of the state of the brakes, the lighting, or poor lighting, driver's inattention. Quite possible that any two of these, or any one, would have been quite sufficient to cause the accident. So equally clear that not one of them was necessary. No, I think whatever else is involved in physical causation, it's not the same as logical entailment. Let's stick to causation and leave clause-ation out of it. The idea of causation as making things happen gets even dodgier when we look at human actions. What were the causes of the English Civil War? Well, as you can see, we can frame different answers here, and people definitely have. But most of them will involve motives, hopes, fears, purposes, future effects that people want to bring about or to forestall. And will anybody claim, actually I think Anne would, that there was a chain of causation or a complex of causation that made the Civil War happen? No. People made it happen. Unless you're a very old-style Marxist, people are not just figures swept along by great historical forces. Oh, if you are an old-fashioned Marxist, come over at the next break and show me that instrument that measures the strength and direction of an historical force. Well, I hope I've dealt with causation as a physical process. Drop the idea. It's, wait for it, it's a lost cause. Right. Now, I'm going on to explanation. And the sort of explanation I'm recommending is well defined in the Oxford Companion to Philosophy. That which produces understanding how or why something is as it is. Also, that one's okay, an act of making something understandable. An explanation, so taken, is not a physical or a metaphysical process, it's a process of communication, of dialogue. First, there's a question, typically beginning why or how. And the question produces an answer, because something or other. And the outcome is understanding. Of course, one answer may not seem satisfactory. If not, further question, further answer, and so on until the curiosity is satisfied. So the full model goes like that. and that middle section, that loop, you can go through it as many times as you like, as indeed parents will be well aware. Do we have time to go through all the verses of "There was no woman who swallowed a fly"? No. Well, just one then. "There wasn't a woman who swallowed a cow. I don't know how she swallowed a cow. She swallowed the cow to catch the goat. She swallowed the goat to catch the dog. She swallowed the dog to catch the cat. She swallowed the cat to catch the bird. She swallowed the bird to catch the spider that wriggled and jiggled and tickled inside her. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly. I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die." Well, in this case, we haven't reached the understanding point, because I don't know why she swallowed the fly. But that's part of the nature of explanation. It's an expression, if I do get to "I see," then my curiosity has been satisfied. I don't know why she swallowed a fly doesn't mean that there wasn't any reason, or that there isn't an explanation, just that I haven't come across one that satisfies me yet. But at least I'm quite clear on what killed her. So, well, you would, wouldn't you? Now, I want to go from that old woman to an old philosopher, Aristotle, who's already appeared on this platform this evening, as he deserves to. Aristotle obviously conceives of a causal investigation as the search for an answer to the question why, a request for an explanation. So think of a cause as simply a certain type of explanation. Fine. And one of the great advantages of taking explanation as the frame is that why questions are far more versatile in getting at the sort of answer that's wanted, the nature of the curiosity to be satisfied. If the first answer doesn't do it, we put another why question until one reaches not the final cause, but the point that puzzled you. Now, of course, you can do the same thing using the vocabulary of cause. What caused this to happen rather than that? But this only says the same thing as "why did this happen" rather than that, and it takes us well away from that chain of causation model. This may be the effect of that, or of X, but this and not that is not an effect, it's a direction, it's the direction of an inquiry, not a physical process. For example, "Why are those dominoes lying like that?" Well, it's a stable position, forces equal and opposite, so I could give an answer in terms of mechanics. But that doesn't satisfy my curiosity, so get to be like that. Oh, well. Because they knocked each other over. So that's the answer in terms of dynamics, I think. But no, I'm still curious. Why did they knock each other over? Well, because Alenka flipped them. An answer in terms of agency. But I'm still curious. Why did she do that then? Because she wanted to try a forking domino effect. And there, as it happens, I see. Now, we have to be vigilant and keep off the formal philosophy freaks again. What they want to do is to lay down the rules according to which we are entitled to be satisfied, taking us right back into laws of nature and logical entailments. Thus, a singular event, E, the explicandum, is explained if and only if the description of E is the conclusion of a valid deductive argument whose premises, the explanans, involve essentially a law-like statement L and a set C of initial or antecedent conditions. In other words, you and I aren't entitled to say when we understand something. We're only allowed to understand it as the logical entailment of premises. In fact, we start this whole philosophical process by transforming observations into verbal constructs. Just what is this single event E? Any single so-called event E can always be alternatively described as two, three, or N events, or as simply one part of a bigger event. Where is the world in which we observe a self-contained event, E, with a clear start and stop? What set of words can ever fully describe any event with complete accuracy? And never mind that law-like statement L may be wrong. Never mind that none of our law-like statements about the real world can be other than provisional. As long as we can deduce an idea of explanation from a law or law-like thing, it doesn't matter if it's a wrong law, apparently. We're still allowed to use it as explanation. And never mind that the set C of initial or antecedent conditions can very properly extend to the state of every nanopixel of space since time began. Unless we can satisfy Hempel's conditions, we're not qualified to understand anything. These are the same formalists who like to define knowledge in such a way that no one can ever be said to know anything. Indeed, they may justify their perversion of explanation by classifying it under the category of epistemology, which they take as the business of knowledge. They are misguided. The old Greek word from which their ology is derived is episteme, I stand. Episteme, almost literally, I understand. I stand in a certain relation to the thing. There is no objective criterion of whether I understand something or understand it properly. By the way, do check out, if you haven't come across them already, a very funny and extended refutation of these formalistic approaches in Hofstadter's Tortoise and Achilles dialogues, where Tortoise reduces poor Achilles to a nervous wreck by simply refusing to accept any single step in Achilles' argument until it has itself been proved as a valid step, and so recursively on. Well, away with the philosophers. Nobody is entitled to tell me that I don't understand something on this basis, and if they are, nobody ever understood anything. It's not up to anyone else to say whether I understand something, or me to say if they don't or do. Of course, people may disagree, for example, about the causes of the English Civil War. I say that you got it wrong, you say that I have. But the test is not whether we agree, it's whether you can ask me a why question, and I can't think of a because that satisfies me. Ask me a relevant question about a topic which I can't answer to my own satisfaction, and okay, there is an aspect which I don't understand. Even that may not disturb my sense, but I grasp the aspects of the question which I regard as important or interesting, that I have an explanation that satisfies me. Explanation as a mental process has no problems with any of the cases which trouble causation as a physical or metaphysical process. Why did the aspidistra die? Because I did not water it, I see, or perhaps why didn't I water it? Because I wasn't there, truly an absent cause. Why didn't I get someone else to do it? Because they didn't have time, etc., etc. All perfectly valid explanations. We don't go on until we've uncovered every node and arrow in some causal network. We go on till our curiosity is satisfied. I see, I understand. Now, likewise, the explanatory model is quite happy with statistical answers, with something that is satisfactorily explained as a frequent, though not a regular, occurrence. It's quite satisfied with reasons that are not contiguous and anterior in time to the outcome or effect in question. We're quite happy with a satisfying explanation that is synchronous, just another way of describing the effect that we're anxious or puzzled about. Or the explanation may delve into the distant past as where today's landscape is explained in terms of Cambrian geology. Explanations are quite at home with explanation with motives as explanations of human behaviour, whether or not the prognosed philosophers will accept those as causes. So, I hope I've explained causation to you. I hope I've explained it away. I hope I've explained explanation itself. I hope, in fact, for a resounding chorus of I see.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I think it's like the thrust and direction of your talk. Although I like the thrust and direction of the talk, I wasn't able to follow you quite as far as you went. It seems to me that there are some aspects which are covered in explanation, i.e. the application of some general rule to specific situations, which we certainly saw in our scientist's presentation of cause and effect. We talked about specific illnesses or epidemics and general rules about them. So I think there is something which is common to explanation and cause there, and you said explanation is sufficient. But there's also this element of temporality, and it does seem to me that the temporal direction is a specific part of a causal connection. And that you're going a little bit far in saying that causal explanations are just like any other explanation, in that causal explanations always do have a temporal part. The example you get, for example, I think where's the temporal, what precedes the spectrum? Well, in that case, the light hits the prism, the spectrum happens. If you put a piece of card after the prism, the spectrum is still there. If you put a piece of card before the prism, the spectrum is not there. So that's how you know that the light is travelling temporarily in a certain direction. And the other one you mentioned was gravity. And this is not something where the temporal order of gravity is very relevant to us because it travels so very quickly. But I do understand from an astrophysicist that it travels at the speed of light, and that this is actually significant if you're looking at what happens when a star explodes and what's the effect on nearby stars. The effect hardly have to take account about the effect won't take place until gravity's had time to reach it. So those examples you gave where you thought that time was nothing to do with it, time was something to do with it, and I'm wondering if perhaps you've gone a little bit far in saying that causal explanations are just explanations, they're a specific sort of explanation.
Well, that's quite a long question. So I don't know if I'll cover all of it. Your first point was about scientific laws, and I did try and deal with that. The laws are those which we infer from the regularities we have perceived. They cannot therefore be used to explain the regularities we've perceived. We have to go a bit further. We can't explain a regularity by saying, well, it's pretty regular, just always happens. We can only explain the regularity by actually getting into an analysis of what actually happens to form iron oxide or whatever. It is no explanation to say that something causes something else. It's just a placeholder for an explanation to follow. Specifically on time, I'm perfectly happy to accept your point about gravity, which I hadn't. I had treated with undue levity, obviously, and not realising that it had a pace of operation. But I won't accept it with prism and spectrum. You wanted to put the cardboard before the prism. I was just going to say where the light strikes the prism cause, you have an effect spectrum, but they're not separated in time. If you don't let the light hit the prism, fine. If you turn the lights out, there's a lot of stuff you won't see also. That doesn't mean that the causal connection between prism and spectrum isn't, as far as I can see, simultaneous. If I've left something else out, tackle me in the break, because
Hello, thanks for that very interesting presentation. I think when you started off, you were differentiating the physical world from, say, social effects. And I wonder if one of the problems that we're doing is that we're not importing into analysing social effects, importing criteria from the physical. Newtonian physics, we apply Newtonian physics principles and laws and rules and to analysing social phenomena, which is probably the problem that we're causing ourselves. We keep insisting on using Newtonian physics methods to, for so why don't we use quantum physics methods to analyze social events and think more around fields and not necessarily causality in the Newtonian physics form?
I don't know if I've quite got your question as you meant it. Would my example of causes of the English Civil War count as one of your social effects? Oh, good. Right. Well, to me, analysing the causes of the English Civil War in terms of quantum physics is a business that I shall leave to someone else. Because when I analyse it in terms of people, I find that I can come up with really quite comprehensible explanations that leave me saying, I see. And I cannot believe that I would be left with any such feeling of comprehension if somebody analysed it in terms of quantum effects operating Penrose-like on the brains of all the people concerned. But that's just me. What satisfies me may not satisfy you, but I prefer motive, etc.
Just a very brief. Why should we apply causality to social events? Why That's probably the issue.
I don't use the term causality as referring to it. It's not a phenomenon. Cause is just a term for saying that, you know, if you like, I'm going to produce an explanation in a minute, but until you produce the explanation, cause doesn't explain anything. It's empty. It doesn't enlighten. You can't use it for analysis. It's meaningless. Until you've explained what you mean by the causation involved, or the causing, or the connection that you think it is taking place, you haven't explained anything. The term cause can be left out, except as a sort of throat clearing for the fact that you're going to begin an explanation next.
It's, the question isn't related to the previous one in one way, but it might be in another. I'm trying to articulate it. It's just that I'm with you when it comes to that search for explanations and that the need to, or that ability to answer subsequent questions one after the other as they arise. In thinking that, I'm thinking in your head, in your search for an explanation, you've got a notion of what it is that would count for an explanation. And that may be, it may be the case that actually some things, it may be some, say, quantum mechanical phenomena, can't actually match any explanation, or, as the gentleman said before, a Newtonian explanation of something. It may be beyond our understanding. I'm just positing this as a suggestion that the search for explanations may have to have within it the acceptance of the fact that something may be beyond our mental capacity to find explanations on our terms.
Two parts there. One is, anybody's free to press me on quantum physics or mechanics, because I know virtually nothing about them, and the little that I do know leaves me totally baffled.
Well, that's my point.
But I don't say that that's because the human brain is not capable of understanding quantum mechanics. My general point would be, all right, one can posit as a sort of abstract proposition that there are things which we will never understand. It's meaningless, it's totally unverifiable that there should or shouldn't be such things. By definition, it's unverifiable. But what I will say as an act of faith is that there is no question that we can pose that we cannot either find a sensible answer to it or satisfy ourselves that we've asked it in such a way that we're not going to get a sensible answer and reframe it so that we do. If we can ask a sensible question, I'm pretty sure we can always find a sensible answer. Act of faith.
We can have time for just one question, but can we make it relatively quick? With Brendan, please.
Carrying on from what you've just said, a sensible question gives a sensible answer, or worse than that. Can I draw you back to what you said, which I thought was very nice, saying physical causation is not the same as logical implication. Right? Can tie that with my question, which is, can language ever translate an event into something that we call philosophy? In other words, can, is it not possible for philosophy to talk meaningfully, in a concerning sense, about causation, because causation is what we see, what we perceive, and that to examine it but philosophically is to go into language, and that is a problem we cannot do.
I hope I roughly explained my views about the attempts to translate descriptions of events into logically watertight verbal statements, and I think it's impossible. And I think that the whole attempt to make the whole enormous cosmos operate within the rules of a few small rules of logical inference is a complete mistake. Whatever, I think I said it again, whatever else we mean when we talk about iron rusting, we do not mean that there is a logical entailment of rust from anything. And I did feel very much with David's very stimulating presentation that a lot was being placed upon this description of an event in words, which very few, if virtually no description can actually bear. Is the breaking of the bottle an event? Is the breaking of this, the neck of the bottle, an event? Is the first shattering of the glass before it comes apart, is that an event? You know, you can play with the words until you've got a syllogism. But the more you play with them to get a syllogism, the further you are, to my mind, from either the laboratory or indeed the understanding. I don't know if it...
Thank you.